Absolutely no partners. For the politician, every party, every social engagement is a puzzle, a crossword to be solved. There are hidden clues, connections to be made, information to be passed on. You solve the puzzle, and then you leave. The Master. 10 years earlier, when the new century was still a kid, that invitation had been new, stiff, and with a thin line of gold leaf around its edges. Just one of several hundred dropping that morning into letterboxes around London, Edinburgh, the Cotswolds. Each had the name of the recipient handwritten at the top in faultless italic, clearly by an expensive fountain pen held by an expensively educated hand. Then came swirls of black embossed Gothic print. Neil Savage invites you to his All Hallows party. Formal wear. Absolutely no partners. Refusals only. The party had been held at Worcestershire Hall in Worcester Square, Mayfair, one of the last grand Edwardian houses still in private hands in central London. The address underlined the lavish nature of the invitation, and refusals had been few. Neil Savage, more properly Lord Lupin, was not in any case a man accustomed to being refused. Private banker, art collector, philanthropist, crossbench peer, he was known for his foul temper and his brilliant wit. "Often disliked, never ignored," he said of himself, with intense satisfaction. And that Halloween, as the black German limousines nudged one another around the dark and windy square, the party had begun with a certain style. Young men, their gold-sprayed torsos bare despite the cold, stood at intervals along the front of Worcestershire Hall, holding blazing torches, so the arrivals had to squint against the billows of smoke and brush small embers off their clothes. Straggling up the Portland stone stairs and into the house, they were greeted by servants in white tie and tails offering cocktails with squid ink and peppers, vodka and absinthe. Champagne was available for the weak-stomached. Lord Lupin himself, dressed all in black with a red bow tie, whiskers painted onto his chalky face, gave a passable imitation of Mephistopheles as he greeted the guests one by one. In they flowed. One former Prime Minister, no, two former Prime Ministers, half a dozen other senior politicians from each party, once feared newspaper editors, minor royals, portly and inclined to be affable, radical playwrights with long, well-cut grey hair, radical establishment artists who made large plastic eggs for the Chinese market, gelded rock musicians, celebrated lawyers, notorious bankers, plus, of course, the shadowy PR men who kept the country moving in the wrong direction. By 7:30 p.m. it was already clear that this was a party like no other. Not a single face here, not one, was anything other than exceedingly famous. In those days, Worcestershire Hall had not yet been gutted, but it was dilapidated. Chilly, underlit rooms with dusty curtains and dirty Dutch pictures led off from one another in endless confusion. "No old masters here, I'm afraid, just old pupils. The family," Lupin said. Dark little staircases spiralled up and down, apparently pointlessly. Only when the guests reached the old ballroom, laid out for a feast and glittering with hundreds of wax candles, was there any real glow of welcome. At one end, a small baroque orchestra was playing melancholy and haunting music, a tripping gavotte, a dying fall. In front of the orchestra, exquisite young men and women dressed as satyrs and fauns were performing some old, complicated dance, as if in a Peter Greenaway film. The guests gathered in knots, broke up again and reformed as they circulated around the house. In even the most neglected rooms, there was always a candelabra and a sofa where a journalist or a photographer might be placed. The flashes of photography ricocheted through the house like perpetual lesser lightning, and there was plenty to photograph. all those seamed, creased, famous faces. The curving eyebrows and drawn, tortured, gathered up and stitched flesh of actresses better known for who they had bedded than for their talent. The pendulous hairy jowls and stained tooth smiles of public servants. There a law officer, here a criminal. And here the two together, a hand resting lightly on a shoulder. Swarming through the dark honeycomb of the house, human crocodiles, human lampreys, human prairie dogs, all jostling and snapping when they spoke. And just as there was plenty to capture, so there was plenty to speak about, so many old friends to discover. Stories of old political battles, long-forgotten legal suits and complicated love tangles were being rehearsed as the drink disappeared. Good old burgundies, flinty unoaked and vintage chardonnays circulated on the silver trays, sweet, succulent southern sunshine for gaping, dusty northern gullets. For those who preferred, the best Islay malts and vintage brandies were there to scald and burn on the way down. The massive mahogany table at one end of the ballroom was expertly stripped by the beautiful staff who brought round plates of bloody grouse, like the aftermath of a Balkan massacre, and slivers of white halibut, and dishes of oysters. All was going swimmingly until about an hour into the party something strange began to happen. It was like a quiet but irresistible wind. The susurration started at the downstairs bar, worked its way up the main staircase, arrived in the ballroom, and then pushed outwards into numerous smaller rooms and crowded corridors. As it shouldered its way through the guests, the disturbance gained strength. Gasps spread with the speed of an epidemic. Mutters grew to the volume of a waterfall. Everywhere there was a shaking of the atmosphere, a shared shock you could touch and watch move from group to group. It was nothing but comprehension. Lupin's boldest artwork taking shape. It was an awakening. The more real, the more the guests looked around. Almost every single person there, they realized, was not just famous, but infamous. Disgraced. There in one corner were those who had lied while taking Britain towards damaging and dishonourable conflicts. Opposite them was a clutch of politicians who had been caught hiring themselves out like common prostitutes. And look, the men who had hired them. And observing it all from the other end of the room were the prominent, well-paid journalists who had ignored it because they were too busy bribing officers of the law in order to destroy decent people. Eating their canapés were NHS bosses who had tried to conceal deaths caused by incompetence and cruelty. Swilling down their wine were bankers who had destroyed their own banks and scurried off with barrow loads of money to roll in after they were stripped of their knighthoods. Loud laughter came from popular entertainers accused of raping young fans and ex-DJs whose paedophile obsessions had become public. All evening, Neil Savage, Lord Lupin, had been waiting, wondering when the penny would drop. The very few who hadn't already been disgraced looked as guilty as if they expected it at any time. There, for instance, nursing a whisky, was the conservative peer Lord Auchinleck, with a face like a swollen, furious baby's and pouchy eyes, his little pot belly squeezed into tartan trews of his own design. Hardly anybody had been invited to Neil Savage's most lavish party who had not been publicly exposed for their greed, lust, or overweening ambition, but mostly greed. Almost without exception, every person there had once been on the front page of a newspaper looking ashamed or shocked, as a photographer tripped over in front of them. What kind of honour was this? What species of revelry? The wind of panic grew stronger. Within minutes, people were uneasily shuffling towards the front door, only to be confronted by another row of cameras. At Worcestershire Hall that night, there was no hiding place. It was a one-time Lord Chancellor who'd lost his job because of his addiction to rent boys and cocaine who confronted the host,
"What the fuck? What the fuck?"
he spluttered, as his large purple forefinger jabbed Savage. Lord Lupin smiled coolly back.
"Fanny, Fanny, we're all friends here. What's the problem? Don't like the food? Don't like the music? You clearly do like the booze. So maybe it's the company." "This is some kind of sick trial by media, you ghastly little shit. Some kind of joke. We are all the punchline," replied the elderly man. "I feel like making you my punchline, actually."
"Calm down, Fanny." By now there was quite a circle of equally upset men and a few women crowding around the banker philanthropist host.
"Yes, all right, I am making a point this evening," said Lord Lupin. "You are the people they would like to disappear. You are the people they would like for their own paltry peace of mind to think of villains, rare creatures who break the rules. But you are not, none of you, anything more or less than ordinary human beings with your appetites and your competitive instincts and, forgive me, your swollen cocks. And you are still here. I am still here. So laugh at disgrace, I say. Mock the smug hypocrisy of the herbivores and dreary midgets who pretend to judge you. Raise your glasses, drink deep, and welcome to the underworld."
Lord Lupin regretted the party when he awoke around mid-morning the following day. After a lifetime of political interference, he'd learned that some of his best jokes had unexpected consequences. It was Lupin, back then simply Neil Savage, the aspiring rock guitarist, who had dissuaded the young Tony Blair from a career at the bar and pointed out to him that the then-failing Labour Party provided the smoothest route into Parliament and onto a front bench. It was he who, as a young man, had turned Boris Johnson away from his youthful Euro-communism and towards the Bullingdon Club. Neither of these pranks had turned out exactly as he had expected. And now there had been a death. It was most unfortunate. The ex-Lord Chancellor had followed Lupin's speech with a bellow, a flailing fist, and a heart attack. Central London Roadworks ensured that the ambulance arrived late, and the overweight grandee expired. On the night for dead souls, there was now one more to remember.